Today in our temptation-themed studies, we want to think about pride. We've settled in on some sources of worldly temptations introduced to us by the Apostle John in 1 John. There he writes, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away in the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever." Pride of life. Pride of life. Pride of life can really be defined as anything that is of the world, obviously, that leads to us having arrogance, pride in self, presumption, boasting, that kind of stuff. John says that anything that produces that pride of life, it comes from a love of the world and worldly ways and worldly mindset. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in them. Pride is a terrible thing. Now, the phrase pride of life, the pride of life, it's only found this one place in the entire Bible. Now, the word pride is found many times, but the phrase pride of life, one time here. But the thing is, the concepts behind it, behind pride of life, especially as it's linked with lust of the flesh and lust of the eyes, it appears in two very significant passages, events. And that is the temptation of Eve and the temptation of Christ. Thinking back to the temptation of Eve back in the Garden of Eden, right? Eve was tempted by the serpent to disobey God and eat the forbidden fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. She perceived that the fruit was good, was pleasing the eye, good for food, that kind of stuff, desirable to make one wise, those kinds of things. And so she lusted after the tree three ways. The first was it was appealing to her appetite, right? Good for food, the lust of the flesh. And so it was also pleasing to look at, lust of the eyes. That's what we studied last week. But third, Eve was also told by Satan that when she ate of that, then she would know good and evil. She would know things that God knows. Part of Satan's lie was that eating that fruit would make Eve like God, knowing good and evil. That appealed to pride, pride of life. The essence of pride, pride of life, is anything that exalts us above our station, above the reality of who we are. We often boast in our arrogance and worldly wisdom and those types of things. Pride is defined as any thinking of self more than reality justifies. Right? Eve really thought that she could be like God, but that's just not true, right? Now, she did gain a knowledge of good and evil, but she didn't become like God. And that's because man could never fully be like God. And of course, then Satan tried the same thing with the temptations of Christ in Matthew chapter 4. Satan tempted Jesus with the lust of the flesh, tempting him to feed his hunger. He tempted him with the lust of the eyes and had him look out over the kingdoms of the world and all their splendor. I'll give those to you. And then he appealed to the pride of life, by daring Jesus to jump from the roof of the temple in order to prove that he was Messiah. God will save you, Jesus. You're Jesus, right? But it wasn't God's will for Jesus to jump. Jumping would have been prideful of Jesus. And the thing is, to this very day, Christians have always been and will always be lured by the same three temptations that Eve and Jesus experienced. But out of the three, Satan's most evil temptation is that pride. Pride of life. Pride goes before the fall. Time and time and time again. I say that because pride of life motivates and is fuel to the fire of those other two lusts, as pride seeks to elevate itself above others, fulfill our personal desires, those types of things. Pride is the root cause of all kinds of things. Strifes in families and churches and nations. Right? Pride exalts self, in direct contradiction to Jesus' statement saying that we should, in order to follow him, we should take up our cross daily and deny ourselves. The pride of life stands in our way. It stands in our way every turn when we want to truly be seeking to serve God. What happens is in just blinded ignorance, we become self-serving and self-satisfied. We think that everything is, that a lot of times we'll think that we have to do everything on our own, no help at all, or we'll see something we want, we'll take action to get it, take pride in the fact that we did. There's so many ways that the pride of life is displayed in our lives. And really what happens is we become idol worshipers, worshiping the God of our lives, the God of self. Now moving forward, in this study many times already, we've read this passage in 1 Corinthians 10:13, Where it says, no temptation has overtaken you except such as common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Right? Now, here's the reason I'm bringing that back up again in this study. And that's because in the preceding context of this verse, it's all about pride. Every last bit of it. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul brings up the Israelites, and he brings up their failures in the wilderness. And all of the things they did wrong were actually couched in the pride of life. Now, the fascinating thing is, Paul doesn't say anything about being proud or prideness until verse 12. We'll get to there in a second. But it's kind of one of those things like, tell me they were proud without telling me they were proud type of things. And we're going to go through the list here. The children of Israel were brought out of Egypt, out of bondage there, and almost immediately they began thinking that they knew better than God. That's pride. They also thought that their particular set of problems were unique to them and that they had to handle them all alone, that kind of stuff, the way that they thought best. Pride. And so Paul wants to make sure that the Christians in Corinth don't follow the same example, and also us to this very day. And so Paul uses six examples from the children of Israel to learn from. So we back up in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and go through the list here quickly. Verse 5, it says, but with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. And again, you got to know your Old Testament to know what he's even referencing here, right? And so what this is the sin Paul refers to here is not trusting in God to take care of the giants that lived in the promised land. But by thinking they stood alone to drive out the enemies in the promised land, the Israelites suffered punishment for 40 years in the wilderness. And I find this element of pride absolutely fascinating, because by thinking only of themselves, by being prideful, the Israelites are blinded to the fact that it's God who would deliver them. God's the one who would deliver them. And the crazy thing about all of that, you'd think that pride would cause them to say, yeah, we're mighty warriors, we'll go in there. Pride did the opposite. Pride did the absolute opposite. And so thinking too highly of themselves, they actually discredit and don't think about God, and they decide they couldn't accomplish what needed to be accomplished because they're only thinking about me, myself, and I. Verse 6, chapter 10, verse 6 up here, it says, now, these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after the things they also lusted. Well, they lusted after lots of things in the wilderness. One example is that Israel lusted for the food that was given to them back in Egypt. And that happened several different occasions. They thought they were all alone and faced their problems no one else had ever faced. And so when God made them go without, they actually wanted to go back to Egypt to slavery. They thought they'd be better off doing things their way in Egypt and trusting God to provide. Verse 7 says, and do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That's a reference to the golden calf incident. Blinded by pride, they believed that they could worship any way that they wanted to. And it was in their pride that hid them from the reality of God. And so the people demanded for physical gods that they could see. And that's when Aaron made the golden calf for them to worship as they saw fit. Verse 8, he says, nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. So this event, the reference here is years after the golden calf incident mentioned in verse 7, many Israelites worshipped with the Moabites, which included sexual immorality. They basically had a repeat performance of the golden calf incident, just with foreigners this time. That's what they did. In pride, they seemed to think that they can get away with this stuff. In verse 9, we read, nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. So in pride, the people complained against God. God had always taken care of them. They thought they could boss God around by complaining about him. So God sent serpents into the camp, killing them. And of course, then God provided a way of salvation that they had to put their trust in. He attacked their pride, right, in order for them to be healed. And then finally, in verse 10, Paul mentions, nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. This is probably a reference to Korah and his rebellion, and then the plague that followed the next day. Korah and his rebellion, all those people, some of them were swallowed up into the earth alive. Another 250 were burned, vaporized instantly. The next day, the people came and complained about it, and a plague hit the camp, and all kinds of people died, right? Right. And so the issue that started there was that they were upset that Moses was the leader and Aaron's the high priest. God chose them to be so, and so the people should have trusted in God's choices. But in their pride, they wanted to do things their way, trusting in self rather than in God. That's the thread that's running through verses 5 through 10, and that becomes crystal clear when we read the rest of our text, starting in verse 11. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the end of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Pride. No temptation has overtaken you, as we've already read. The Israelites were clearly caught up in the sin of pride of life. They had the attitude of we know better, we can do better, it's all on me, I'm standing alone in the face of all these troubles of this world, I alone am responsible for my well-being. And if we're not careful, we'll fall prey to this just like they did. And we will ruin our relationship with God like they did. That's the whole point that Paul's making here. But next, I want to add to that the way that pride ruins our relationships with each other. Not only does it ruin our relationship with God, that's obvious, but it causes all kinds of trouble down here under the sun. And to do that, I simply got a list of things that we do, things that we do to others when we've given into the temptation of the pride of life. And the first is fault finding. You know, pride causes us to really filter out the evil that we could see in ourselves. It also causes us to filter out the goodness that we should see in others. Right? It causes us to elevate self while we also tear others down, making us hypocrites. Jesus said this in Matthew 7. He said, "And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the speck from your eye,' and look at a plank is in your own eye?" Hypocrite. First, remove the plank from your own eye, and then you'll see clearly remove the speck from your brother's eye. Now here's the thing, and we're going to read the next passage when we get to Galatians 6, right? We're supposed to help the faults in others, right? We're supposed to help correct sinful behavior in others. But when we're proud, we just point out the sin in others and never really see it in ourselves. Pride will cause us to be fault finders, and we only do so to feed our pride. We won't be looking to help our brethren. Instead, we'll be pushing them away with our self-righteous judgment of them, that kind of stuff. But also, it'll cause us to be harsh towards others. Galatians 6:1 on the board here says, "Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted." Those who have pride in their hearts, they often speak of other sins with contempt or irritation or frustration or judgment. Yeah, in pride, we fail to see that we too are a person who sins. We're a person who has faults. Thinking we're better than others gives us license to be mean to them. Another thing that we do, being proud, really, it makes us become quite superficial. When pride, you know, lives in our hearts, right? We're far more concerned with others' perceptions of us than the reality of our own hearts. We only fight off the sins that others may see. Sadly, we'll be fine with the sins in our lives that no one sees. And another part of that plays into that, often pew warmers really are often born out of pridefulness. They don't put in the effort to build relationships with the brethren. And often that's because their lives are going to be exposed for what they really are. I mean, and so we got a couple passages here, Hebrews 10, 24, and let us consider one another. Right? Stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. Philippians 2, 3 and 4, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. In pride, we don't do that stuff, right? When we're prideful people, we don't engage in these things. We don't consider one another, and therefore we aren't going to work at being a better Christian. We won't care about growing with the mindset of helping others to grow. Pride says, I don't need exhortation, I don't need to give exhortation. Tied to that, prideful people usually become defensive with others. It goes hand in hand with being a superficial Christian. If we engage in any spiritual activity, it's only enough to put on a show. Well, then what happens if we're challenged for being superficial? Defensiveness. In pride, we think, you don't tell me how to live, right? You have no right. You don't tell me I should want to be with my brothers and sisters. You don't tell me how I should prioritize spiritual matters, that kind of, who do you think you are, right? That kind of thing. Pride makes it really hard for us to practice so many passages in the Bible. We won't be thinking more highly of others. We sure aren't going to be letting others look out for our best interest. I'm fine just the way I am. Thank you very much. And the sad part also is pride typically causes people to be desperate for attention, hungry for attention, respect, adoration in all its forms. Maybe it's just shameless boasting about ourselves. Maybe it's being unable. Sometimes, pride manifests itself in crazy ways. Some people, because of their pride, they can't say no to anyone because they need to be needed. That's a pride thing. And I think that's one reason why John calls it the pride of life. It just permeates throughout all of our lives. Pride is concerned with me, myself, and I. And so all my behaviors, my decisions, my interactions, they're all going to have the end goal of making sure that I get what I want. And of course, finally tied to the last, and pride will end up neglecting others. Right? Pride prefers some people over others. James talks a lot about this. Several other passages talk about it. It honors those who we would deem worthy of honor, giving more weight to certain people than others. For when we have pride in our life, there's a thrill that comes when people of even more power acknowledge me, that kind of stuff. We pass over the weak, the inconvenient, the unattractive, the people who are too much effort, right? In pride, we're just better. We're just better than a lot of people, and so we neglect them. And so, that's a quick rundown. There's so many more harmful ways that pride can affect us. So it can ruin our relationship with God. We've seen that as exemplified in Israel. We've touched on a short list of how it affects our interpersonal relationships. I want to finish today with how do we fight off that temptation of the pride of life? The book of James gives us the ultimate death blow to the pride of life, removing it from ourselves. If we just hold one particular fact of life in our minds, if we could just hold on to that from moment to moment, we would never display pride in our lives. James reminds us that we have no control. In the end, we have, it's a shocking amount of control that we actually do have. It's very little, right? And James reminds us we have no control, and that fact is an absolute pride killer if we just let it settle in. James 4, 13 through 16. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall go or we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Now, James isn't preaching against planning ahead here, right? That's not the issue. He's preaching against having this mindset that whatever we plan to do is actually going to happen as if we have ultimate control. Because there is so much that we cannot guarantee. There is so much where we are really quite powerless. And the whole point here is to be humble, right? That is a humbling, humbling thing. And I think that's one reason why I want to think of that term pride of life. Here's how this works. You got up this morning, right? Just like you did the day before, and the day before, and the day before. And you start to take it for granted. And you just set your mind to do certain things, because I woke up again, I'm going to wake up tomorrow like I did the day before, so I'm going to make plans for tomorrow. And then you accomplish those plans, or you'll do this, or you'll do that, and you work your way through life. And what happens is there's this self-confidence, which there should always be some kind of self-confidence, but then it can go too far, right? I've done this, I've done that, I've done that. And all of us can list those things. And there's nothing wrong with a lot of those things. I could have you sit down and write your list of accomplishments in life, right? And it's what you're going to do. That's why it's life. That's part of life. It's part of living, right? But then what happens, though, is we start to become proud. We take those things for granted. That's what James is attacking here. And he's saying, no, don't become proud because of those things. I could keel over dead before the end of this sentence. I just finished that one. It might happen the next one. Guess what? There is not a thing any one of us in this room can do about it. Not a thing. You let that settle in. I think a lot of times we don't want to think about that, right? Ooh, right? That's not a chipper message. But with that being the case, that I could keel over dead at the end of the next sentence, what on earth in this life under the sun is worth being prideful about? What's worth being prideful about? We bring nothing into this world. We take nothing out of this world. Every last thing that we do here is only because God has allowed it. We have no control. And if we keep that in mind, all that pride of life, that pride that comes just because we have life, it's because of the system we live in. We keep that in mind, we'll keep that pride at bay. Think about some simple things. If I gave you 10 pennies and I marked one of them with a Sharpie with an X and I said, put them in your pocket, right? You can't even, and I told you, I want you to, the first one you pull out, I want it to be the one with the X. Can you do it? You got a 1 in 10 chance, right? You don't have control over 10 pennies in your pocket. You don't. Isn't that crazy? Right? It's amazing. Sometimes frightening how little control we actually have, and that should keep us very humble people. The only reason we have life is because God gave it to us. And when it's time for us to die, there's nothing we can do about that. There is simply no logical reason for us to be prideful people. But because of life, because the world keeps on turning, we're still in it, we start to get the big head. And so that's why James asked for what is your life. These guys are boasting about their big plans and their merchandise and also that, what is your life? In the big scheme of things, what does all that stuff really matter? Your big plans and the money you're going to make? If our lives vanish like a vapor, then what's all that stuff about? These guys are boasting what they are in the world. What happens when they're gone, right? Does their wealth, their business, their legacy, does it really mean that much in the big scheme of things? Does it really add up to much? How many people have died and eventually they're essentially forgotten? How many of you people know Katherine Humbertson? And did anybody ever know Katherine Humbertson? And she was a tremendous lady. I've been cleaning all of her trash out of my house for 2 years. She went to Bishop Walsh, and if you could win an award at Bishop Walsh, she won it. She went to 4 different colleges, 4 different degrees. I don't know how many papers we've gotten rid of from her. She saw the entire world. We threw out pictures from, she saw the world, right? She's been there, done that. She lived it, right? She did all kinds of things, and of course she kept track of all that stuff. And you know where all that stuff that she kept track of is? The latest batch is in a dumpster in my driveway. And Tuesday, there'll be a bulldozer in Frostburg pushing it with dirt. That's what happens. It comes at you quick. And even if you did know Catherine, you haven't thought about her in any time. She's been dead for 2.5 years, right? That's what happens. And that's what James is talking about. That's what keeps us humble. And even if Catherine would have had somebody to take all of her stuff instead of just leaving it for me to take it out of her house, even if she had kin, even if she had kids, another generation or two, she's just a name as you go back in time. They don't know her, right? Apart from God, on a worldly level, our intrinsic value is greatly lacking. The world keeps on spinning without us. That's what the book of Ecclesiastes is about. The whole idea is like, whoa, this is all vanity. You better hold on to God. He's the only thing you got. So keeping that in mind, what's it worth to be prideful about? James answers the question by saying, life is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. How much effect does vapor have in the whole scheme of things? Well, if you came in for the beginning of Bible study, you drove through all kinds of vapor, right? It was pretty foggy out this morning. It's gone, just like that. It's here for such a short amount of time. There's only one glory that lasts, and that's God's glory. Man has no substance in which to glory except in God. James provides us with the solution for pride of life, and that is to remember that life is fleeting, and there's nothing to be proud about. These men thought they were in control of their lives. They're forgetting one thing. They're forgetting that God is in control. That's why he just says instead they ought to say, if the Lord wills, then we shall do this or do that. We need to give credit to the one who is in control, the one who gives value to our lives, the one in whom we have substance. Make sure we have substance in Christ Jesus. It's only in God that we actually live and move and have our being, as Paul was trying to teach them in Athens in Acts chapter 17. The answer to surviving the temptation of the pride of life is to acknowledge the power of God and make sure we put it into our plans. The remedy for pride of life is to put our faith, our trust, our hope in God, which means that we are going to make sure we know his word, and then we are going to be doers of his word, living by faith in him, obeying him, which is also going to affect every one of our interpersonal relationships. Let's do the work to make sure we're not like the Israelites were. Let's make sure that we trust in God, not in ourselves. And then let's also remember the damage that pride brings to all of our relationships with each other, too. Let's remember that even though we are so very blessed, we are really just a vapor We really have very little control, but thankfully, in Christ Jesus, we have so much more to look forward to. It's all worthwhile as long as we maintain and keep that pride out of our lives. This morning, let's be encouraged to do the right thing, live the right life, make sure we have our lives dedicated to God. Think about those things as we stand and sing.